Lutze turned the little shovel over and over in his hand.
"Very fast," he said.
He leaned down and blew the petals away from a tiny glacier.
"You slice time as fast as a tenth gem, and as yet barely trained. You must have been a great thief. And now, oh dear, I shall have to face you in the dojo."
"No, there is no need," said Lobsang, because now Lutze looked frightened and humiliated and somehow smaller and brittle-boned.
"I insist," said the old man. "Let us get it done now, for it is written, there is no time like the present, which is Mrs. Cosmopolite's most profound understanding."
He sighed and looked up at the giant statue of Wen.
"Look at him," he said. "He was a lad, eh? Completely blissed out on the universe. Saw the past and future as one living person, and wrote the books of history to tell how the story should go. We can't imagine what those eyes saw, and he never raised a hand to any man in his life. Look, I really don't want to, and you've looked at the other statues," said Lutze, as if he'd completely forgotten about the dojo.
Distractedly, Lobsang followed his gaze. Up on the raised stone platform that ran the whole length of the gardens were hundreds of smaller statues, mostly carved of wood, all of them painted in garish colours. Figures with more eyes than legs, more tails than teeth, monstrous amalgamations of fish and squid and tiger and parsnip. Things put together as if the creator of the universe had tipped out his box of spare parts and stuck them together, things painted pink and orange and purple and gold, looked down over the valley.
"Oh, the Dalang," Lobsang began. "Demons, that's one word for them," said the sweeper. "The abbot called them the enemies of mind. Wen wrote a scroll about them, you know, and he said that was the worst."
He pointed to a little hooded grey shape, which looked out of place amongst the festival of wild extremities.
"Doesn't look very dangerous," said Lobsang.
"Look, sweeper, I don't want to—" "They can be very dangerous, things that don't look dangerous," said Lutze. "Not looking dangerous is what makes them dangerous, for it is written you can't tell a book by its cover."
"Lutze, I really don't want to fight you."
"Oh, your tutors will tell you that the discipline of a martial art enables you to slice time, and that's true as far as it goes," said Lutze, apparently not listening. "But so can sweeping, as perhaps you have found. Always find the perfect moment," Wen said. "People just seem so keen on using it to kick other people on the back of the neck."
"But it wasn't a challenge. I just wanted you to show me,
and I shall. Come on. I made a bargain, I must keep it. Old fool that I am."
The nearest dojo was the dojo of the tenth gym. It was empty except for two monks blurring as they danced across the mat and wrapped time around themselves. Lutze had been right, Lobsang knew. Time was a resource. You could learn to let it move fast or slow, so that a monk could walk easily through a crowd and yet be moving so fast that no one could see him. Or he could stand still for a few seconds and watch the sun and moon chase one another across a flickering sky. He could meditate for a day in a minute. Here in the valley, a day lasted forever. The blurred fighters became a couple of hesitant monks when they saw Lutze. He bowed.
"I beg the use of this dojo for a short period while my apprentice teaches me the folly of old age," he said.
"I really didn't mean—" Lobsang began, but Lutze elbowed him in the ribs. The monks gave the old man a nervous look.
"It's yours, Lutze," said one of them.
They hurried out, almost tripping over their own feet as they looked back.
"Time and its control is what we should teach here," said Lutze, watching them go. "The martial arts are an aid, that is all they are. At least, that's all they were meant to be. Even out in the world, a well-trained person may perceive in the fray how flexible time may be. Here, we can build on that. Compress time, stretch time, hold the moment. Punching people's kidneys out through their nose is only a foolish byproduct."
Lutze took down a razor-edged pika sword from the rack and handed it to the shocked boy.
"You've seen one of these before," They're not really for novices, but you show promise.
Yes, sweeper, but
know how to use it?
I'm good at the practice ones, but they're just made of...
Take it, then, and attack me.
There was a rustling noise above them. Lobsang looked up and saw monks pouring into the observation gallery above the dojo. There were some very senior ones amongst them. News gets around quickly in a little world.
Rule two, said Lutse, is never refuse a weapon.
He took a few steps back.
In your own time, boy.
Lobsang wielded the curved sword uncertainly.
Well,
said Lutse,
I can't just... Is this the dojo of the 10th gym?
Said Lutse.
Why, mercy me, I do believe it is. That means there are no rules, doesn't it? Any weapon, any strategy, anything is allowed. Do you understand? Are you stupid?
But I can't just kill someone because they've asked me to.
Why not? What happened to Mr. Manners?
But
you are holding a deadly weapon. You are facing an unarmed man in a pose of submission. Are you frightened?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Good. That's lesson three, said Lutse quietly. See how much you're learning already? Wipe the smile off your face, have I? All right. Put the sword on the rack and take a dakka stick. The most you can do with that is bruise my old bones.
I would prefer it if you wore the protective padding.
You're that good with the stick, are you?
I'm very fast.
Then, if you don't fight right now, I shall wrest it from you and break it over your head,
said Lutse, drawing back.
Ready? The only defence is to attack well, I'm told.
Lobsang raised the stick in reluctant salute. Lutse folded his hands and, as Lobsang danced towards him, closed his eyes and smiled to himself. Lobsang raised the stick and hesitated. Lutse was grinning. Rule two, rule three. What had been rule one? Always remember rule one.
Lutse!
The abbot's chief acolyte arrived panting in the doorway, waving urgently. Lutse opened one eye and then the other one, and then winked at Lobsang.
Narrow escape there, eh?
He said. He turned to the acolyte.
Yes, exalted sir. You must come immediately, and all monks who are cleared for a tour in the world, to the Mandala Hall, now!
There was a scuffling in the gallery, and several monks pushed their way out through the crowd.
Ah, excitement, said Lutse,
taking the stick from Lobsang's unresisting hands and putting it back into the rack. The hall was emptying fast. Around the whole of Oi Dong, gongs were being banged frantically.
"'What's happening?'
said Lobsang as the last of the monks surged past.
"'I dare say we shall soon be told,'
said Lutse, starting to roll himself a cigarette.
"'Hadn't we better hurry? Everyone's going!'
The sound of flapping sandals died away in the distance.
"'Nothing seems to be on fire,' said Lutse calmly. "'Besides, if we wait a little, then by the time we get there, everyone will have stopped shouting, and perhaps they'll be making some sense. Let us take the clock path.' The display is particularly fine at this time of day.
But,
it is written, you've got to learn to walk before you can run,
said Lutse, putting his broom over his shoulder.
Mrs. Cosmopolite again? Amazing woman, dusted like a demon too.
The clock path wound out from the main complex, up through the terraced gardens, and then rejoined the wider path as it tunnelled into the cliff wall. Novices always asked why it was called the clock path, since there was no sign of a clock anywhere. More gongs started to bang, but they were muffled by the greenery. Lobsang heard running feet up on the main path. Down here, humming birds flickered from flower to flower, oblivious to any excitement.
I wonder what the time is, said Lutse, who was walking ahead.
Everything is a test. Lobsang glanced around at the flower bed.
9:15, he said.
Oh? And how do you know that?
The field marigold is open, the red sandwort is opening, the purple bindweed is closed, and the yellow goatsbeard is closing, said Lobsang.
You worked out the floral clock all by yourself?
Yes, it's obvious.
Really? What time is it when the white water lily opens?
6:00 a.m.
You came to look?
Yes, you planted this garden, did you?
One of my little efforts.
It's beautiful.
It's not very accurate in the small hours. There aren't too many night-blooming plants that grow well up here. They open for the moths, you know.
It's how time wants to be measured, said Lobsang.
Really? Of course, I'm not an expert, said Lutze.
He pinched out the end of his cigarette and stuck it behind his ear.
Oh, well, let's keep going. Everyone may have stopped arguing at cross purposes by now. How do you feel about going through the Mandala Hall again?
Oh, I'll be fine. I'd just forgotten about it, that's all.
Really? And you'd never seen it before, too. But time plays funny tricks on us all. Why, I once...
Lutze stopped and stared at the apprentice.
Are you all right? He said. You've gone pale.
Lobsang grimaced and shook his head.
Something felt odd, he said.
He waved a hand vaguely in the direction of the lowlands, spread out in a blue and grey pattern on the horizon. Something over there. The glass clock. The great glass house, and here, where it shouldn't be, the glass clock. It was barely here. It showed up as shimmering lines in the air, as if it was possible to capture the sparkle of light off a shiny surface without the surface itself. Everything here was transparent. Delicate chairs, tables, vases of flowers. And now he realized that glass was not a word to use here. Crystal might be better, or ice. The thin, flawless ice you sometimes got after a sharp frost. Everything was visible only by its edges. He could make out staircases through distant walls. Above and below and to every side, the glass rooms went on forever. And yet, it was all familiar. It felt like home. Sound filled the glass rooms. It streamed away in clear, sharp notes, like the tones made by a wet finger around a wineglass rim. There was movement, too, a haze in the air beyond the transparent walls, shifting and wavering and watching him.
How can it come from over there, and how do you mean odd? Said the voice of Lutze.
Lobsang blinked. This was the odd place, the one right here, the rigid and unbending world. And then the feeling passed and faded.
Just odd, for a moment, he mumbled.
There was dampness on his cheek. He raised his hand and touched wetness.
It's that rancid yak butter they put in the tea. I've always said so, said Lutze. Mrs. Cosmopolite's never... Now that is unusual, he said, looking up.
What? What? Said Lobsang, looking blankly at his wet fingertips and then up at the cloudless sky.
A procrastinator, going over speed.
He shifted position.
Can't you feel it?
I can't hear anything, said Lobsang.
Not here. Feel. Coming up through your sandals. Oops. There goes another one. And another. You can't feel it. That's old 66. They've never got it properly balanced. We'll hear them in a minute. Oh, dear, look at their flowers. Do look at their flowers.
Lobsang turned. The ice plants were opening. The field sow thistle was closing.
Time leak, said Lutze. Hark at that. You can hear them now, eh? They're dumping time randomly. Come on.
According to the second scroll of When the Eternally Surprised, when the Eternally Surprised sawed the first procrastinator from the trunk of a wham-wham tree, carved certain symbols on it, fitted it with a bronze spindle, and summoned the apprentice Clodpool.
Ah, very nice, master, said Clodpool. A prayer wheel, yes?
No, this is nothing like as complex, said Wen. It merely stores and moves time.
That's simple, eh?
And now I shall test it, said Wen.
He gave it a half turn with his hand.
Ah, very nice, master, said Clodpool. A prayer wheel, yes?
No, this is nothing like as complex, said Wen. It merely stores and moves time.
That's simple, eh?
And now I shall test it, said Wen.
He moved it a little less this time.
That's simple, eh?
And now I shall test it, said Wen.
This time he twisted it gently to and fro.
That's simple pull, eh? Simple, eh?
Said Clodpool.
And I have tested it, said Wen.
It worked, Master?
Yes, I think so. Wen stood up. Give me the rope that you used to carry the firewood, and, yes, a pit from one of those cherries you picked yesterday.
He wound the frayed rope around the cylinder and tossed the pit onto a patch of mud. Clodpool jumped out of the way.
See those mountains? Said Wen, tugging the rope.
The cylinder spun and balanced there, humming gently.
Oh, yes, Master,
said Clodpool obediently. There was practically nothing up here but mountains. There were so many that sometimes they were impossible to see because they got in the way.
How much time does stone need? Said Wen, or the deep sea. We shall move it.
He placed his left hand just above the spinning blur to where it is needed. He looked down at the cherry pit. His lips moved silently, as though he was working through some complex puzzle. Then he pointed his right hand at the pit.
Stand back, he said,
and gently let a finger touch the cylinder. There was no sound except the crack of the air as it moved aside and a hiss of steam from the mud. Wen looked up at the new tree and smiled.
I did say you should stand back, he said.
I shall get down now, then, shall I?
Said a voice among the blossom-laden branches.
But carefully, said Wen,
and sighed as Clodpool crashed down in a shower of petals.
There will always be cherry blossom here, he said.
Lutse hitched up his robe and scurried back down the path. Lobsang ran after him. A high-pitched whine seemed to be coming out of the rocks. The sweeper skidded at the carp pond, which was now erupting in strange waves, and headed down a shady track alongside a stream. Red ibises erupted into flight. He stopped and threw himself flat on the paving slabs.
Get down, now!
But Lobsang was already headlong. He heard something pass overhead with a plangent sound. He looked back and saw the last ibis tumbling in the air, shedding feathers surrounded by a halo of pale blue light. It squawked and vanished with a pop. Not vanished entirely. An egg followed the same trajectory for a few seconds and then smashed on the stones.
Random time! Come on, come on!
Shouted Lutse. He scrambled to his feet again, headed towards an ornamental grill in the cliff face ahead of them, and with surprising strength wrenched it out of the wall.
It's a bit of a drop, but if you roll when you land, you'll be okay, he said, lowering himself into the hole. Where does it go to? The procrastinators, of course.
But novices aren't allowed in there on pain of death.
That's a coincidence, said Lutse,
lowering himself to the tips of his fingers.
Because death is what awaits you if you stay out there, too.
He dropped into the darkness. A moment later, there was an unenlightened curse from below. Lobsang climbed in, hung by his fingertips, dropped and rolled when he hit the floor.
Well done, said Lutse in the gloom. When in doubt, choose to live. This way.
The passageway opened into a wide corridor. The noise here was shattering. Something mechanical was in agony. There was a crump, and a few moments later, a babble of voices. Several dozen monks, wearing thick cork hats as well as their traditional robes, came running round the corner. Most of them were yelling. A few of the brighter ones were saving their breath in order to cover the ground more quickly. Lutse grabbed one of them, who tried to struggle free.
Let me go! What's happening? Just get out of here before they all go!
The monk shook himself free and sped after the rest of them. Lutse bent down, picked up a fallen cork helmet, and solemnly handed it to Lobsang.
Health and safety at work, he said. Very important.
Will it protect me? Said Lobsang, putting it on.
Not really, but when they find your head, it may be recognizable. When we get into the hall, don't touch anything.
Lobsang had been expecting some vaulted, magnificent structure. People talked about the procrastinator hall as if it was some kind of huge cathedral. But what there was at the end of the passage was a haze of blue smoke. It was only when his eyes became accustomed to the swirling gloom that he saw the nearest cylinder. It was a squat pillar of rock about 3 yards across and 6 yards high. It was spinning so fast that it was a blur. Around it the air flickered with slivers of silver-blue light.
See, they're dumping! Over here, quick!
Lobsang ran after Lutse and saw there were hundreds, no, thousands of the cylinders, some of them reaching all the way to the cavern roof. There were still monks in here, running to and from the wells with buckets of water, which flashed into steam when they threw it over the smoking stone bearings at the base of the cylinders. "Idiots," the sweeper muttered. He cupped his hands and shouted, "Where is the overseer?" Lobsang pointed down to the edge of a wooden podium built onto the wall of the hall. There was a rotting cork hat there and a pair of ancient sandals. In between was a pile of grey dust. "Poor fellow," said Lutse. "A full 50,000 years in one jolt, I'd say." He glared at the scurrying monks again. "Will you lot stop and come here? I ain't going to ask you twice." Several of them swept the sweat out of their eyes and trotted towards the podium, relieved to hear any kind of order, while behind them the procrastinators screamed. "Right," said Lutse, as they were joined by more and more. "Now listen to me. This is just a surge cascade. You've all heard of them. We can deal with it. We just have to cross-link futures and pasts. Fastest ones first." "Oh, Mr. Shoblang, already tried that," said a monk. He nodded at the sad pile. "Then I want two teams." Lutse stopped. "No, we haven't got time. We'll do it by the soles of our feet, like we used to do. One man to a spinner, just smack the bars when I say. Ready to go when I call the numbers?" Lutse climbed onto the podium and ran his eye over a board covered with wooden bobbins. A red or blue nimbus hovered over each one. "What a mess," he said. "What a mess!" "What do they mean?" said Lobsang. Lutse's hands hovered over the bobbins. "Okay, the red-tinted ones are winding time out, speeding it up," he said. "The blue-tinted ones, they're winding time in, slowing it down. Brightness of the colour, that's how fast they're doing it. Except that now they're all freewheeling because the surge cut them loose, understand?"
"Loose from what?"
"From the load. From the world. See up there?" He waved a hand towards two long racks that ran all the way along the cavern wall. Each one held a row of swivelling shutters, one line blue, one line dark red. "The more shutters showing a colour, the more time winding or unwinding. Good lad, got to keep it balanced. And the way we get through this is we couple the spinners up in twos, so that they wind and unwind one another. Cancel themselves out. Poor old Shoblang was trying to put them back into service, I reckon. Can't be done, not during a cascade. You've got to let it all fall over and then pick up the pieces when it's nice and quiet." He glanced at the bobbins and then at the crowd of monks. "Right, you, 128 to 17, and then 45 to 89. Off you go. And you, 596 to, let's see, yes, 402. 790, shouted Lobsang, pointing to a bobbin. "You what?" 790. "Don't be daft, that's still unwinding, lad. 402 is our man right here. 790 is about to start winding time again. It's still bright blue. It's going to wind. I know it because..." The novice's finger moved over the lines of bobbins, hesitated, and pointed to a bobbin on the other side of the board. "It's matching speeds with this one." Lutse peered. "It is written, well, I'll go to the foot of our stairs," he said. "They're forming a natural inversion." He squinted at Lobsang. "You're not the reincarnation of someone, are you? That happens a lot in these parts."
"I don't think so. It's just obvious."
"A moment ago, you didn't know anything about these." "Yes, yes, but when you see them, it's obvious." "Is it? Is it? All right, then the board's yours, Wonder Boy." Lutse stood back. "Mine, but I..." "Get on with it. That is an order."
For a moment, there was a suggestion of blue light around Lobsang. Lutse wondered how much time he'd folded around himself in that second. Time enough to think, certainly. Then the boy called out half a dozen pairs of numbers. Lutse turned to the monks.
"Jump to it, boys. Mr. Lobsang has the board. You boys just watch those bearings."
"But he's a novice," one of the monks began,
and stopped and backed away when he saw Lutse's expression.
"All right, sweeper. All right."
A moment later, there was the sound of jumpers slamming into place. Lobsang called out another set of numbers. While the monks dashed to and fro to the butter pits for grease, Lutse watched the nearest column. It was still spinning fast, but he was sure he could see the carvings. Lobsang ran his eye over the board again and stared up at the rumbling cylinders and then back to the lines of shutters. There wasn't anything written down about all this, Lutse knew. You couldn't teach it in a classroom, although they tried. A good spin driver learned it through the soles of his feet for all the theories that they taught you these days. he'd learn to feel the flows, to see the rows of procrastinators as wells or fountains of time. Old Choblang had been so good that he'd been able to pull a couple of hours of wasted time from a classroom of bored pupils without their even noticing, and dump it into a busy workshop 1,000 miles away as neat as you pleased. And then there was that trick he used to do with an apple to amaze the apprentices. He'd put it on a pillar next to them, and then flick time at it off one of the small spindles. In an instant, it'd be a collection of small spindly trees before crumbling to dust. "That's what'll happen to you if you get things wrong," he'd said. Lutze glanced down at the pile of grey dust under the disintegrating hat as he hurried past. Well, maybe it was the way he'd want to go. A scream of tormented stone made him look up.
"Keep those bearings greased, you lazy devils," he yelled, running down the rows. "And watch those rails. Hands off the splines. We're doing fine."
As he ran, he kept his eyes on the columns. They were no longer turning randomly. Now they had a purpose.
"I think you're winning, lad," he shouted to the figure on the podium. "Yes, but I can't balance it. There's too much time wound up and nowhere to put it." "How much?"
"Almost 40 years. Lutze glanced at the shutters. 40 years looked about right, but surely...
"How much?" he said.
40, I'm sorry, there's nothing to take it up."
"No problem, steal it. Shed load, we can always pull it back later. Dump it."
"Where?"
"Find a big patch of sea."
The sweeper pointed to a crude map of the world painted on the wall.
"Do you know how to... can you see how to give it the right spin and direction?"
Once again there was the blueness in the air.
"Yes, I think so." "Yes, I imagine you do. In your own time, then."
Lutze shook his head. 40 years? He was worried about 40 years. 40 years was nothing. Apprentice drivers had dumped 50,000 years before now. That was the thing about the sea. It just stayed big and wet. It had always been big and wet. It would always be big and wet. Though maybe fishermen would start to dredge up strange whiskery fish that they'd only ever seen before as fossils. But who cared what happened to a bunch of codfish? The sound changed.
"What are you doing?"
"I found space on number 422. It can take another 40 years. No sense in wasting time. I'm pulling it back now." There was another change of tone.
"Got it? I'm sure I've got it."
Some of the bigger cylinders were already slowing to a halt. Lobsang was moving pegs around the board now faster than the bewildered Lutze could follow. And overhead the shutters were slamming back, one after another, showing age-blackened wood instead of colour. No one could be that accurate, could they?
"You're down to months now, lad."
"Months," he shouted.
"Keep it up." "No, blimey, you're down to days. Days! Keep an eye on me."
The sweeper ran towards the end of the hall to where the procrastinators were smaller. Time was fine-tuned here on cylinders of chalk and wood and other short-lived materials. To his amazement, some of them were already slowing. He raced down an aisle of oak columns a few feet high, but even the procrastinators that could wind time in hours and minutes were falling silent. There was a squeaking noise. Beside him, one final little chalk cylinder at the end of a row rattled around on its bearing like a spinning top. Lutze crept towards it, staring at it intently, one hand raised. The squeaking was the only sound now, apart from the occasional clink of cooling bearings.
"Nearly there," he called out. "Slowing down now, wait for it. Wait for it."
The chalk procrastinator, no bigger than a reel of cotton, slowed, spun, stopped. On the racks, the last two shutters closed. Lutze's hand fell.
"Now, kill the board, no one touch a thing."
For a moment, there was dead silence in the hall. The monks watched, holding their breath. This was a timeless moment of perfect balance. Tick. And in that timeless moment, the ghost of Mr. Choblang, to whom the scene was hazy and fuzzy, as though seen through a gauze, said,
"This is just impossible. Did you see that?"
"See what?"
said a dark figure behind him. Choblang turned.
"Ah,"
he said, and added with sudden certainty,
"You're death, right?"
"Yes, I am sorry I am late."
The spirit formerly known as Choblang looked down at the pile of dust that represented his worldly habitation for the previous 600 years.
"So am I,"
he said. He nudged Death in the ribs.
"Excuse me."
"I said, I'm sorry I'm late. Boom, boom.
I beg your pardon.
You know, sorry I'm late. Like dead?
Death nodded.
Oh, I see. It was the boom, boom. I did not understand.
That was to show it was a joke,
said Shoblang.
Yes. I can see how that would be necessary. In fact, Mr. Shoblang, while you are late, you are also early, boom, boom.
Pardon?
You have died before your time.
Well, yes, I should think so.
Do you have any idea why? It's very unusual.
All I know is that the spinners went wild, and I must have copped a load when one of them went over speed,
said Shoblang.
But hey, what about that kid, eh? Look at the way he's making the buggers dance. I wish I'd had him training under me. What am I saying? He could give me a few tips.
Death looked around.
To whom do you refer?
That boy, up on the podium, see him?
No, I'm afraid I see no one there.
What? Look, he's right there, plain as the nose on your face. Well, obviously not on your face.
I see the coloured pegs moving.
Well, who do you think is moving them? I mean, you are Death, right? I thought you could see everyone.
Death stared at the dancing bobbins.
Everyone that I should see, he said.
He continued to stare.
Said Shoblang.
Oh, yes. Where were we?
Look, if I'm too early, then can't you...
Everything that happens stays happened.
What kind of philosophy is that?
The only one that works.
Death took out an hourglass and consulted it.
I see that because of this problem, you are not due to reincarnate for 79 years. Do you have anywhere to stay?
Stay? I'm dead. It's not like locking yourself out of your own house,
said Shoblang, who was beginning to fade.
Perhaps you could be bumped up to an earlier birth.
Shoblang vanished. In the timeless moment, Death turned back to stare at the Hall of Spinners. Tick! The chalk cylinder started to spin again, squeaking gently. One by one, the oak procrastinators began to revolve, picking up the rising load. This time there was no scream of bearings. They twirled slowly like old ballerinas, this way and that, gradually taking up the strain as millions of humans in the world outside bent time around themselves. The creaking sounded like a tea-clipper rounding Cape Wrath on a gentle breeze. Then the big stone cylinders groaned as they picked up the time their smaller brethren couldn't handle. A rumbling underlay the creaking now, but it was still gentle, controlled. Lutze lowered his hand gently and straightened up. A nice clean pickup, he said. Well done, everyone. He turned to the astonished, panting monks and beckoned the most senior towards him. Lutze pulled a ragged cigarette end out of its lodging behind his ear and said, Well, now, Rambert Handysides, what do you think happened just now, eh?
Oh, well, there was a surge which blew out...
after that, said Lutze, striking a match on the sole of his sandal. See, what I don't think happened was that you boys ran around like a lot of headless chickens, and a novice got up on the platform and did the sweetest, smoothest bit of rebalancing I've ever seen. That couldn't have happened, because that sort of thing does not happen, am I right? The monks of the procrastinator floor were not among the temple's great political thinkers. Their job was to tend and grease and strip down and rebuild and follow the directions of the man on the platform. Rambert Handyside's brow wrinkled. Lutze sighed. See, what I think happened, he said helpfully, was that you lads rose to the occasion, right? And left myself and the young man there aghast at the practical skills you all showed. The abbot will be impressed and blow happy bubbles. You could be looking at some extra momos in your thugpa come dinner time, if you get my drift. Handysides ran this up his mental flagpole, and it did indeed send prayers to heaven. He began to smile. However, said Lutze, stepping closer and lowering his voice, I'll probably be around again soon. This place looks as though it could do with a good sweeping.
and if I don't find you boys pin sharp and prodding Buttock inside a week, you and I will have a talk. Smile vanished. Yes, sweeper. You've got to test them all and see to those bearings. Yes, sweeper. And someone clear up Mr. Shoblang. Yes, sweeper. Fair play to you, then. Me and young Lobsang here will be going. You've done a lot for his education.
He took the unresisting Lobsang by the hand and led him out of the hall, past the long lines of turning, humming procrastinators. A pall of blue smoke still hung under the high ceiling.
"Surely it is written, you could knock me down with a feather," he muttered, as they headed up the sloping passage. "You spotted that inversion before it happened. I'd have blown us into next week, at least."
"Sorry, sweeper."
"Sorry? You don't have to be sorry. I don't know what you are, son. You're too quick. You're taking to this place like a duck to water. You don't have to learn stuff that takes other people years to get the hang of. Old Shoblang, may he be reincarnated somewhere nice and warm, even he couldn't balance the load down to a second. I mean, a second? Over a whole damn world?"
He shuddered.
"Here's a tip. Don't let it show. People can be funny about that sort of thing."
"Yes, sweeper."
"And another thing," said Lutze,
leading the way out into the light.
"What was all that fuss just before the procrastinators cut loose? You felt something?"
"I don't know. I just felt everything went wrong for a moment."
"Ever happened before?"
"No. It was a bit like what happened in the Mandala Hall."
"Well, don't talk about it to anyone else. Most of the high-ups these days probably don't even know how the spinners work. No one cares about them anymore. No one notices something that works too well. Of course, in the old days, you weren't even allowed to become a monk until you'd spent 6 months in the hall, greasing and cleaning and fetching. And we were better for it. These days, it's all about learning obedience and cosmic harmony. But in the old days, you learned that in the halls. You learned that if you didn't jump out of the way when someone yelled, 'She's dumping,' you got a couple of years where it hurt. And that there's no harmony better than all the spinners turning sweetly."
The passage rose into the main temple complex. People were still scurrying around as they headed for the Mandala Hall.
"You sure you can look at it again?" said Lutze.
"Yes, sweeper."
"Okay, you know best."
The balconies overlooking the hall were crowded with monks, but Lutze worked his way forward by polite yet firm use of his broom. The senior monks were clustered at the edge. Rinpo caught sight of him.
"Ah, sweeper," he said. "Some dust delayed you." "Spinners cut free and went over speed," muttered Lutze. "Yes, but you were summoned by the abbot," said the acolyte reproachfully. "Upon a time," said Lutze, "every man jack of us would have legged it down to the hall when the gongs went." "Yes, but..."
said the abbot, and Lobsang saw now that he was being carried in a sling on the acolyte's back, with an embroidered pixie hood on his head to keep off the chill.
"Lutze always was very keen on the practical approach."
He blew milky suds into the acolyte's ear.
"I am glad matters have been resolved, Lutze."
The sweeper bowed, while the abbot started to beat the acolytes gently off the head with a wooden bear.
"History has repeated, Lutze, dum dum bum dum brrrr."
"Glass clock," said Lutze.
The senior monks gasped.
"How could you possibly know that?" said the chief acolyte. "We haven't rerun the mandala yet." "It is written, I've got a feeling in me water," said Lutze. "And that was the only other time I ever heard of when all the spinners went wild like that. They all cut loose. Time slip. Someone's building a glass clock again."
"That is quite impossible," said the acolyte. "We removed every trace."
"Ha! It is written, I'm not as green as I'm cabbage looking," snapped Lutze. "Something like that you can't kill. It leaks back. Stories, dreams, paintings on cave walls, whatever."
Lobsang looked down at the mandala floor. Monks were clustered around a group of tall cylinders at the far end of the hall. They looked like procrastinators, but only one small one was spinning, slowly. The others were motionless, showing the mass of symbols that were carved into them from top to bottom. Pattern storage. The thought arrived in his head. That is where the mandala's patterns are kept, so that they can be replayed. Today's patterns on the little one, long-term storage on the big ones. Below him, the mandala rippled, blotches of colour and scraps of pattern drifting across its surface. One of the distant monks called out something, and the smaller cylinder stopped.